From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we discuss the storied relationship between the U.S. and Iran and unpack what's happening now. Then, a look at some community events happening in the city this month, and we'll learn about Milwaukee's special connection to MLK Day.
Milwaukee, actually, this is a nice piece of history we own nationally. Since 1984, Atlanta, Georgia, and Milwaukee are the only two cities in the country who have continuously celebrated Dr. King's birthday.
Plus, we find out why homeowners of all ages are now competing for a type of house that was often overlooked, ranch homes.
They say, oh, I hate ranches because they think of that. They think of maybe their grandparents' ranch house. But the truth is, you don't have to have that style, and you can absolutely can remodel a ranch home easier than a two-story.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. The killing of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani has brought renewed attention to the complex relationship between the U.S. and Iran. For decades, there have been major conflicts between these two countries, and over the past few years, these conflicts have intensified. Shale Horowitz is a political science professor at UW-Milwaukee, and he joins me to discuss U.S.-Iran relations and rising tensions. Horowitz starts by answering the question on many Americans' minds, who was General Soleimani?
Qasem Soleimani was a major bad guy. This guy has been running Iran's foreign legion to spread its revolution throughout the region for 20 years, approximately. He's usually regarded or often regarded as the number two in Iran. He's the enforcer of the supreme leader. And he has blood on his hands all over the region and in Iran itself. So most recently, he's been the one who's been killing demonstrators by the thousands in Iran and in Iraq that are demonstrating against the regime and its local domination. And also he's been poking the U.S., trying to prompt some kind of more intense conflict as a way of relieving U.S. sanction pressure.
When you say poking the U.S., what does that look like? What has that looked like?
So we've seen a series of escalating moves by Iran over about the last year or so. People will probably remember most of these. So there was the attack on shipping in the Persian Gulf. There were the attacks on the Saudi oil fields. And there have been, just within the last few months, 11 attacks that the U.S. military counts on U.S. military bases in Iraq. And, of course, attacks throughout the regions. There are civil wars going on in Yemen, in Iraq, in Syria. You know, low-intensity violence elsewhere in the Middle East, all of which they're participating in. And he is the leader of the Iranian militias.
This is a really loaded question because I know that the relationship between the U.S. and Iran is long and storied. But when we look at this most recent attack in context of our larger relationship with this country, what are some important things to know?
The basic thing to keep in mind is let's not think about it as countries. So Iran is dominated by a theocratic regime that right now is really run by one person and those closest to him in the political hierarchy in Iran. So that person, there have only been two such leaders since 1979. And so those regimes are the ones the U.S. is interacting with. And basically, this is a revolutionary regime which is imposing its theocracy, of course, in Iran, and it believes it's a true model for the entire Islamic world and ultimately for the rest of the world. And it is imposing this system as much as it can. And one of its problems is that it's become increasingly unpopular in Iran, and the main way to keep its legitimacy going is to keep on intensifying international conflicts, because that is a way for them to divert attention away from their internal problems.
As you look into recent things that have happened between the Trump administration and the Iranian government, it does go back a little ways.
Yeah, I mean, of course, it goes back to 1979. This most recent Iranian attack on the U.S. embassy in Iraq had echoes of the seizure of hostages in Iran in 1979. Everybody knows about that parallel. But this is a complicated question. I think we want to focus on a particular aspect of it. I mean, there's both the question of this kind of long-term ideological Cold War, which Iran has with really the rest of the world, but above all the U.S. and its allies in the region. And then there's the shorter-run conflict, which is happening between the Trump administration and Iran, which is a continuation in a different way from what went on under previous American presidents.
So what has the relationship looked like over the last couple of years?
Yeah, so just as some background, so basically the way that the Obama administration tried to deal with Iran was an approach of basically trying to give them a lot of what they wanted in the hopes that that would change their behavior. And so the Trump administration, of course, doesn't agree with that. They think that that's made Iran more aggressive and that it's not stopping Iran from getting nuclear weapons. So the Trump administration has reimposed economic sanctions. And these economic sanctions are biting very heavily in Iran. So Iran is suffering economically. At the same time, it's involved in all of these external conflicts, and it's very unpopular internally. So the government's in a difficult situation, and it would rather have a conflict with the United States and other outsiders than a conflict with the Iranian people or the Iraqi people. So that is really the situation in which Iran is escalating now. And I think that, you know, President Trump is known for wanting to get out of the Middle East. Like, for example, a lot of people believe that he unwisely did not support the Kurds in Syria, pulled out of there too early. His base does not want him getting involved in a major conflict in the Middle East. So what he's trying to do is have a kind of a standoff type of conflict, which doesn't involve too much risk for the United States, but which still tries to keep Iran in check. We don't know if that's going to succeed, but that appears to be the strategy.
At the same time, the president has been making threats, specifically on Twitter, some of which are actually considered war crimes. He's said that he'll target Iranian cultural sites. This is a practice that a number of terrorist groups have done in this same region. And there is a concern among many that in making these threats, we are alienating our international partners.
You know, President Trump is unusual in that he does not vary his message for different audiences. He really only speaks to an American audience, and he speaks in ordinary language. So, for example, when he says we would strike at sites which are culturally important to Iran, we have to try to figure out what he means by that because he doesn't speak precisely. So I don't think he means we're going to find, you know, like thousand-year-old monuments or something in Iran, or purely cultural monuments. I think what he means by that is the United States, under his leadership, is willing to strike at Iran's leadership if the conflict intensifies too much. So what he means by that, probably, I'm just guessing here, is that they're not safe. That's what the killing of Soleimani shows, right? In other words, they can't assume that the United States is just going to retaliate against Iraqi militias or conscripts in Iran or something like that. So I believe that's what he means. If he really means that he's going to strike at things which are just Iranian cultural sites, I mean, that would be ridiculous and counterproductive.
It seems like already we're having some issues with allies. How have they responded in general to the killing of Soleimani and the potential, as some have said, of a war between the U.S. and Iran?
Two questions there.
Yeah.
Let's start out with allies. I mean, basically, there are different kinds of allies. I think the allies in the region are pretty supportive because this guy is really scary to them and is a major threat to them. So the moderate Sunni Arab states, Israel, obviously they support this because this guy is their primary enemy, the primary threat to the really continued existence of their regimes or their states. And then the European countries are, of course, different. So they are usually very risk averse. They don't want any kind of major disruptions militarily or economically. They typically want to deal with things purely through negotiations. And they certainly don't like it when Trump speaks on Twitter in a way which doesn't address them or doesn't address others. It just addresses an American audience. So they're not happy, obviously. But this is fairly typical to Trump's overall strategy in the Middle East, right? That is, those that are benefiting from it most directly, those that agree most with what he's doing, support it. Those that don't really have very much of a stake in these kind of short-term changes in strategies, but rather just want to avoid any instability, they tend to be more opposed. Now, getting to the risk of a war, I think there's no way that we're going to have an Iraq-style war. I mean, Trump would never do that. He's publicly opposed things like that over and over again. I think he knows it would be a political disaster. That's not an effective way of striking at Iran. In the same way, Iran is not going to attack the United States using conventional weapons because it's inferior to the United States. So I'm pretty sure that what we're going to see is this kind of calibrated low-intensity warfare where Iran uses its proxies in the region, its militias, or it uses low-intensity attacks like on U.S. embassies or U.S. Navy ships or other American targets in the region, and the United States responds primarily with airstrikes or, let's say, naval strikes against specific Iranian military facilities, proxy facilities, or maybe, you know, like command and control centers in Iran if things really escalate. I don't see that either side has an incentive to engage in conventional warfare.
Is it significant, then, that we have deployed more troops to the Middle East, to Iraq?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you have to be prepared for any eventuality that arises. If you don't have troops there, you may as well get out completely. Those troops that we have there are really in numbers which can only work if we have allies to work with. We're not there in numbers that would allow us to fight in any way independently against Iran. So, for example, in Iraq, Iran is taking over the country, has largely taken over the country through its proxies. Like Soleimani for months has been acting as if he's basically the head of state in Iraq. These guys, including the other guy that was killed with him, Mohandas, they're openly standing there while these militias are attacking the U.S. embassy. These guys are at the top of the Iraqi government. So this is not a tenable situation for the U.S. If the Iraqi government is not going to allow the U.S. to protect its own troops and embassy, we cannot stay there. So basically what the government appears to be doing is it appears to be saying, we're going to protect ourselves. We're going to support any local Iraqis that are willing to stand with us. But if there are no local Iraqis that are well enough organized, even though they oppose the Iranian militias, to really fight them, we're going to end up having to pull out of there because we're not going to have local allies.
Well, and the Iraqi government has requested that the United States vacate Iraq. Do we think that's going to happen?
It could happen. If you look at the video of that vote in the Iraqi legislature, you'll notice that the room is half empty. So what was going on there basically is that almost half the legislators didn't show up because, Iraqi Hezbollah, whose leader was assassinated along with Soleimani, they threatened to kill anybody that didn't vote in favor of that bill, asking the U.S. to withdraw. So that's what we have, right? We have a situation where a large segment of Iraqi people, Iraqi political parties, they don't want to be an Iranian puppet state. They want Iraq to be an independent state. And they know they can only do that by having U.S. assistance. So they don't want the U.S. to leave. But the Iranian-backed militias are more powerful and more aggressive. And so far, they've been able to dominate. And that may continue. And if that does, then we will not be able to stay there.
Is it significant that these incidents happened in Iraq?
Iraq is a good place for Iran to fight the U.S. because it's got these very effective large proxy forces on the ground. So as we discussed, Iran is going to search for methods of conflict or theaters of conflict in which it has a local advantage. So that is why we should not be surprised that, you know, long before the attack on the embassy, they've been attacking bases with U.S. troops to try to kill U.S. troops. So the killing of Soleimani is basically the U.S. saying, we're not going to stand by while you slowly bleed us to death. We're going to fight you if you try to do this, and maybe we'll lose. But the situation where we're just attacked without responding is not a tenable one in Iraq.
Well, and the Trump administration has said that part of the reason for the attack was a list of potential targets from the Iranian government, specifically from General Soleimani. Have we seen any evidence to corroborate that?
Don't forget that this guy is actively fighting conflicts for years everywhere, including in Iraq. And in every one of these theaters, they're constantly planning to attack any American presence. So it goes without saying that they're looking into doing this on a constant basis. I don't know what the intelligence is on the recent attacks, but this is an area where we already have the evidence. In other words, there have already been so many attacks in Iraq that it's a no-brainer.
Which I guess some people have questioned then, well, why now then, unless there was some kind of very imminent threat?
I think that the best, the most persuasive explanation that I've seen about that is Trump has been holding off responding to a number of these provocations, especially the attacks in the Persian Gulf and on the Saudi oil fields, and the downing of the American drone, where a lot of people were calling for retaliation. And what he stated as his quote-unquote red line was American casualties. So this particular escalation began when one of these attacks on a U.S. base wounded American soldiers and killed an American contractor. So that's when he escalated by attacking these Iraqi Hezbollah bases in Iran, in Iraq. And then there was the attack on the embassy. And at that point, everyone feared a repetition of the hostage situation in the Iraqi embassy. So the embassy was reinforced. And basically, the killing of Soleimani is a message that we are going to escalate in response to you here. We're not just going to take these pinprick attacks. And so now this is a good battlefield for Iran. So if I were them, this is where I would choose to escalate against the U.S. in Iraq.
Well, and Iran has said that they will no longer abide by the 2015 denuclearization deal, which, of course, the United States had already stepped out of. But there were other signatories. What are the logical implications of that statement?
This is actually not new. This is a process of statements they've been making that they're gradually breaking out from the agreed restrictions of the nuclear agreement. And it makes sense that they would do that because the value of this agreement for them is that after 10 to 15 years after signing passes, they can legally construct a large-scale nuclear program which will allow them to quickly acquire large numbers of nuclear weapons. Now, if they cannot do that, right, if the agreement isn't going to be implemented, which it seems like it's not going to be, then they have no incentive to continue to abide by it. In other words, I think what they were hoping for was that European desire to stay in the agreement would pressure the Trump administration successfully to come back into some version of the agreement that would preserve it. But probably what they're imagining is that if they go back to the negotiating table now, since the time is almost up and they would be able to start building their nuclear weapons program out quickly, that there would be new restrictions imposed upon them and a new agreement. So probably they're saying, well, there isn't going to be an agreement now, so we're just going to move away from the agreement and behave as if it's not binding. Mm. That's my interpretation, but I don't know.
Shale Horowitz is a political science professor at UW-Milwaukee and an expert on foreign policy. We'll take a short break now, then we'll return with Adam Carr for the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service to talk about some community events happening in the city this month. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. For many, January is a kind of renaissance, a time to remind ourselves of personal goals and recommit to them. Most resolutions are about self-improvement, and January's list of local events is a great place to start. Every month, we're joined by someone from the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service to talk about some of the community events happening in Milwaukee's Central City. For January, many of these events are about getting to know your neighbors, diversifying your worldview, and celebrating icons of civil rights. Adam Carr is the Deputy Editor for Community Engagement at the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, and he joins me now in studio. Adam, thank you so much for being here.
Absolutely. It's 2020, and there's lots going on already.
There's so much going on already. We were just talking about this before the microphones were turned on, but it seems like the beginning of the year is the beginning of everything to some extent.
Absolutely, yeah. The way the years end, a lot happens, and if you're like me, you kind of like hold on, and you get to the new year, and then you look up, and there's so much waiting for you, and 2020 is no different. Specifically, in Milwaukee neighborhoods, January is a great month to get out and go do things.
So the first thing, interesting title, I think, that will both vibe and offend everyone.
Sure. It is named OK Boomer / Snowflake, Beyond the Generational Divide. This is an event that the Zeidler Center for Public Discussion is putting on. Full disclosure, I'm a board member there. But when I saw this, it's really to understand that OK Boomer, many of you out there may have heard this, is kind of a internet meme that's gained popularity recently in the last year. And it's kind of used to be dismissive or mocking of the baby boomer generation. The name of the title also makes reference to Snowflake, which is kind of a also sort of a slangy term that's a little bit dismissive for millennials who have a inflated sense of uniqueness or entitlement. And this event kind of takes on a playful attitude, but the Zeidler Center, what they're really good at doing is having difficult conversations, conversations that might be debates or contentious, that when we have them in our digital spaces, oftentimes quickly devolve into name-calling. And really, they have a structured methodology for having conversations. I've done these many times over the years. You both get a chance to tell your story, but you also get to listen much more than you actually talk, which I think is a really important thing to do, usually with people you don't know, which is, to me, it might sound a little intimidating, but I totally trust the Zeidler Center to really capably facilitate that kind of conversation.
You may have already said this, but what are the dates on that?
So this event is happening actually tonight. So it's the 7th from 7 to 8:30, and it's at the Frank Zeidler Center for Public Discussion, which is located within the Redeemer Church on Wisconsin Avenue. You can look up the information, but yeah, it is tonight.
So the second event, also searching for diversity, a diversity of perspective as well.
For sure, yeah. So we had intergenerational diversity in our first event. The second one, it is actually named Diverse Dining, and it's coming up on Tuesday, January 14th, so coming up in a week. This is a dining series that a woman named Emeril Mills started. She's not from Milwaukee. She moved here. She's very interested in just getting out of the boxes we're all very familiar with. You know, we know segregation, siloing. And for a lot of people, that kind of constricting, you know, they want to get beyond it. So she just took the initiative to start. I actually talked to her right before she did her first one. It's kind of an experiment. Just get together people of different cultural backgrounds, different walks of life, just to eat food, which is something we all know can bring people together. And it's been really successful. She's done this since 2018. And another nice feature is you get to meet people you don't know. You get to share your story. She also, without exception, I've seen her make her events at really great restaurants around town. And this one is at Damascus Gate, which is a Syrian restaurant on Mitchell Street. So this restaurant actually started in 2019. If you haven't had a chance to go there yet, I've been there a number of times. Really delicious food made by a family who came here from Syria, and just sharing what they do with the delicious food they make with this group. So it is a ticketed event. I don't have the exact cost for it, but Tuesday, January 14th, it is Diverse Dining. And actually their subtitle for this one is The Pursuit of Happiness, which I think is a great way to start the new year.
Yeah. Going out into another kind of area, it's the story of a neighborhood.
Absolutely. I personally, as I suspect many of your listeners, I work for Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. I live in a neighborhood. Neighborhoods are a really deep and important part of the identity of Milwaukee. There's a lot of different ways of understanding neighborhoods, of learning their stories. So on January 18th, on Gallery Day, so not Gallery Night, but the day after, the Mobile Design Box, which is on North 27th Street in the Sohi area, that's a project that the UWM School of Architecture and Urban Planning has been running for a number of years in that location. They're doing a thing called The Story of a Neighborhood, and they're doing a visual exploration of Milwaukee's Near West Side neighborhoods. So Avenues West, Cold Spring Park, Concordia, Martin Drive, Merrill Park, Miller Valley, The Valley, and Pigsville. I practiced that once before. They're all phenomenal neighborhoods with incredible presence, with incredible pasts, and all of them with, I anticipate, a great future. So what they've done is gone back in archives. They've looked up from the 20s to the present different visual accounts of those neighborhoods. So plans, photos, renderings, and these are architects. So oftentimes, I mean, personally, when you see these architectural drawings, they're almost more interesting than seeing the actual building, you know? So they're going to be looking at, they've kind of just unearthed all these different pieces of the past to just kind of tell a different kind of story, both a visual one, but the plans, the blueprints, all these kinds of things for those seven neighborhoods on the Near West Side in Milwaukee. And I'm really looking forward personally to going and seeing places I know I'm familiar with in a totally different way.
Very interesting. It's such a unique way to look at a neighborhood.
Absolutely. I will say, like, I've had a chance to do work with architects on a few occasions, and I always am interested in the way they see the world, and I love that this is a chance for them to even kind of dig into the past of how architects have helped shape those neighborhoods and, just put that on display. So the Near West Side neighborhoods are wonderful places, and it's a way of seeing it in a different way on Saturday, January 18th during Gallery Day at the Mobile Design Box.
So digging into our own past, really, here in Milwaukee, but also nationally, I'd forgotten that January, among so many other things,
yes,
is also when Martin Luther King Jr. Day is going to
absolutely
be. You have a couple of celebrations.
For sure. One piece of trivia first. You know that the Stevie Wonder song, Happy Birthday, the very happy, that one, I'm not going to sing it. That is actually written as a way of advocating for making Martin Luther King's birthday a nationally celebrated holiday, actually. So that song, which is well known and people might think it's about them, is actually a piece of advocacy in Milwaukee, actually. This is a nice piece of history we own nationally. Since 1984, Atlanta, Georgia, and Milwaukee are the only two cities in the country who have continuously celebrated Dr. King's birthday, which is wonderful. So there's wonderful events around town, and I think kind of, to me, the two big ones that I'm aware of every year, and again, I'm not trying to be complete with this, but on Sunday, January 19th, the Marcus Center every year does a wonderful celebration where really at the center of it are the voices of youth. They have art of all kinds, so visual art, speech, writing contests. There's also dancing and music. It's kind of a showcase of students from around Milwaukee. Actually, also the Wauwatosa Public Schools and West Bend Public Schools participate in this too, so you can see a little bit from our whole area and region. And, you know, I have gone to that event a number of times, and, you know, just as a member of the public, and it always... It's a way to experience our community in a way that might, you know, you drive by school buildings all the time and then hearing these young, incredible MPS students speak passionately about the legacy of Martin Luther King is amazing. And this year's theme is Your Life Has Significance. So that's on Sunday, January 19th from 1 to 3 p.m. at the Marcus Performing Arts Center. It's totally free. The other event is actually on MLK Day itself, or the day it's celebrated, which is the Monday on January 20th. To me, the Milwaukee Public Library every year puts on a phenomenal showcase at the Martin Luther King branch, which actually in that library, they have a Black History specific collection as well. So it's a great place all year, but specifically on Monday the 20th, they have a full day of activities from 9 to 5 p.m. Their morning really focuses on kind of like DIY things. So they have a bunch of different crafts, a bunch of different activities, art projects that you can have that are guided by great community members, and also the teens that work there. The afternoon, so starting at noon, there's a sort of a series until almost the end of the day of great performances. So the Golda Meir School will be doing a performance to pay tribute to the legacy of Dr. King. Tan Kothi, which is the youth group of Kothi, will be there. X Fabula is doing things, signature dance. Alpha Phi Alpha does a trivia contest. An artist named Fatima Laster, who's amazing, is doing work there. So all day at the MLK Library on Monday the 20th, there's great stuff going on. Morning's kind of more do-it-yourself. Afternoon is a great program of different performances.
Well, and with that same idea of artists, the last event is actually a lecture from an artist.
Absolutely. So this is my last one for January. I do always feel a little guilty come on and saying, these are like five things that we strongly recommend from Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. We're not saying these are the only or the best, but they are things that we think are wonderful. So the fifth one is no exception to that. Portia Cobb is a great filmmaker in Milwaukee, an artist. She's a professor at UW-Milwaukee, and we've had the great privilege of her. She's written some op-eds for us at Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service in the past year. So we've kind of had some exposure, our audience, to see her in that way. But on January 29th, she's doing a lecture talking about her own personal work, which ranges from film and video to photographic essays. She does installations. I know actually she's taken on her own family story, her aunt Lizzie, and her own roots in the Gullah Geechee, kind of dreaming a possibility of post-emancipation. It's all very interesting and abstract. She's actually done gardening at the Linden Sculpture Garden, and she's started a conversation of food between Milwaukee and her roots, where she's been actually bringing and growing food from where her family is from in the Carolinas. So she's a phenomenal person. She does really interesting work. She's also just a person I just love talking to, so I'm interested to see her lecture. And a lot of times, you know, a person like Portia, who's a great professor, she's known in Milwaukee in different ways. It's great to just see a little bit of what she does as a person, as an artist, as a filmmaker. So again, that's going to be at UWM at the Peck School of the Arts on Kenwood on January 29th is when Portia Cobb's lecture is. So lots happening in Milwaukee neighborhoods throughout 2020, and I think January, as always. You know, when I put together these lists, I always think, I really hope this month will be a great one. You know, I want to make sure the listeners hear about wonderful events happening throughout Milwaukee's North and South Side neighborhoods, and without fail, there's always interesting stuff.
No shortage of events.
Absolutely. We could keep going on, but with that, I think our time is up. So thank you, and we'll keep seeing you throughout 2020.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us, Adam Carr. Carr is the deputy editor for community engagement at the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. You can find more of our conversations with them about Milwaukee's central city neighborhoods at wuwm.com. Although Milwaukee's central city is a bustling urban center, you can still see your fair share of wild animals. One of the most common culprits is the wild turkey. For author J.F. Reardon, turkeys aren't just curious anomalies on city streets. They're a regular part of her routine. One turkey in particular made a real impression.
We live at Turkey Central. It started out small a few years ago when we would occasionally hear turkey calls in the spring. But now there are turkeys, about 40 of them, who roost in our trees every night, and their comings and goings are part of the rhythm of our days. At dawn and at dusk, you can look up into the tops of the trees and see these unwieldy, bulbous creatures precariously perched on the tiniest of branches 50 feet above the floor of the woods. I have no idea how they manage to stay there, but so far, I've seen no evidence of them falling. They make quite a lot of noise, too, which I rather enjoy. For those pedants among you, I draw your attention to the fact that wild turkeys constitute a flock. Domestic turkeys constitute a rafter or a gang. I don't know. One of my great pleasures in life is to watch the turkeys at dusk flying one by one up to their nighttime berths. They gobble as they make a running start with a long rumble like a B-52 at takeoff, and then unexpectedly they take to the air and with a great flapping land on a perfectly unsuitable branch, bobbling back and forth as they establish their balance. This takes some time, and it is most enjoyable to watch with a cocktail in hand, preferably bourbon, but I'm not always particular. We frequently attempt to bore our guests with it, but everyone who witnesses it seems as riveted as we are. Last year, we had one turkey who broke the routine. Instead of using the little hill in the woods for his launch, he would courageously mount the big hill to our house where dogs do dwell. He would get almost to the top, near the patio, and then he would turn and run down the hill, his wings flapping, using the hill for acceleration on takeoff. My husband commented on it one night in amazement, and after that, the turkey came, this one bird, alone, every night. I came to think of this bird as an innovator, a cultural leader, possibly breaking the Darwinian bonds of avian technology. I looked for him, I admired him, and I was delighted by him. Then came turkey season. I don't hunt, so I don't know what the rules are about where you can shoot or when or how, but I can say that the number of turkeys was considerably diminished. As winter came on, there were only about a dozen left, and our innovator was gone. The flock that remained continued its old habits without variety or novelty. In my heart, I know what probably happened. but I like to think of him laboriously climbing the perilous hill alone, undaunted, his vision of glory before him as he turns and begins the run to take off, lifting up exultantly from the earth, closer and closer to the sun, on his way to immortality. It's spring again, and we have more turkeys than ever, but not the innovator. The flock has lost some of its magic for me. He was a turkey, and I think of him every day.
Wisconsin writer J.F. Riordan's latest book is a series of essays called Reflections on a Life in Exile. Riordan read her essay for us called Maybe Icarus Was a Turkey. Coming up next, despite the winter season, the housing market has not cooled off. We'll find out why ranch homes are heating up the housing competition when Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. Now, I'm Joy Powers. Ranch homes, they're controversial. Still, despite their association with shag carpet and wood paneling, these homes are in high demand. With the help of the GI Bill and FHA affordable housing after World War II, the one-story home exploded in popularity. They're found all over southeastern Wisconsin, and according to the Greater Milwaukee Association of Realtors, they made up 41% of the homes sold in the four-county area through July of 2019. This has to do, in part, with older homeowners looking to downsize and millennials looking for their starter home. To learn more about the appeal of ranch homes, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski was joined by Diedrich and Lewis Weyer, owner and president of Carmel Builders. Weyer starts by explaining why ranch homes and their characteristics became so popular.
Easy to build, really quick to build was the issue, because you had this situation where you had literally, you know, hundreds of thousands of soldiers, young men mostly, all coming back from being overseas, wanting to start families right away, and the housing need like just blew up. If you think about it, you took a bunch of young men in there, you know, really like 16 to 20 years old, and they left home and were gone for a lot of them for, you know, 7 or 8 years, and then all of a sudden back, and now you're a young adult and you can't just go back and live with mom and dad. But during that whole time period of the war effort, there were no houses being built. I mean, the entire U.S. economy and the industrial complex was the war. And so all of a sudden you come back to the States and there's no houses. So it was a quick and easy way to get them up.
So what's the criteria for ranch homes? You know, would you consider all homes that are one story technically a ranch, or does this differentiate?
I guess I would.
Yeah. I mean, I low profile, right?
Yeah.
Single family, one story, usually at L shape or U shape.
I think here in Wisconsin, for sure, single stories
are
ranch.
Yeah, we can limit it to Wisconsin. Yeah.
I would say, in my mind, if I consider something a ranch, it is still built probably between 1940s to 1980s. There are ranch homes still being built now that are technically single story homes, but I don't really classify those in my mind as a ranch.
So what's in your mind that classic ranch? What does it look like?
You know, it's probably somewhere from like, what do you think, like 1,000 to 2,200 square feet. They don't get much bigger than that.
Yeah, not too much bigger than that.
Generally low pitched roof.
Right. Long overhanging eaves.
Yeah, generally pretty big overhangs. Windows are generally set up a little bit higher on them. And that would be compared to like a modern-day ranch, you know, which you pull up to, it doesn't look like a single-story home. You know, I guess in my mind, that's not really a traditional ranch, but you could make the argument it is.
And with Wisconsin, I know in California for sure there's not a lot of basements at all with those ranch homes. But in Wisconsin, do most ranch homes here have basements?
We do, and we like our basements.
we need it. Wisconsin. I mean, I tell people this all the time, and we don't realize it. We take it for granted here. But we live in probably about the craziest weather that we have in the country, because we get everything from temperature range of well over 100 degrees. We have humidity from 0% to 100%. And it's just, you need basements to keep your houses stable.
It's definitely a selling feature too. With the size of the ranch home, that just gives you, affords you more space for recreation. And, you know, you put in a couple egress windows and now you have some livable square footage that you can put down there too for an extra room, bedroom, or what have you.
Very true.
It's nice.
That's a good point.
Yeah. So within Milwaukee, you know, southeastern Wisconsin area, where are we going to find a majority of ranch homes that were built here?
So, I mean, we can go all the way, you know, we have ranch homes in Cudahy, we have them in Menomonee Falls, Germantown, Glendale, Fox Point, scattered throughout Wauwatosa. So really, there's not too many communities where I can't find a ranch home. There's just going to be a few more that you gravitate to a little bit more heavily. And as Lewis said, they're still building ranch homes, which I found was kind of a nice surprise. I didn't know that it was still as prevalent for new builds.
I do want to get into that because I find that either people love ranch homes or they hate them. Have you both found that experience with working with people?
Well, yeah, but, you know, I find that people change their views on that. I mean, I grew up in a ranch home. I said, I'm never going to live in a ranch home. I lived in every type of home other than a ranch home. And then I ended up having children. Those children happened to be twins. And I was going up and down three flights of stairs. And my home now is a ranch. And I love it. So people that have kind of ideas about ranch homes, depending on where you are in your life, you might really change your idea of them. And I think the mindset of what you can do with a ranch home really changes when you get into some of the rehab capabilities. People not necessarily need more space, but they want that master bath. Not necessarily that they need an extra bathroom, they want the master bathroom. So the ability to make that into your existing ranch home is what really appeals to it as well.
When people say they hate ranch homes, what I find is that they generally hate 70s style decorating and layouts. Because that's what they think when they think of it. Because that's probably like the peak ranch era, probably like what, like 1965 to 1980, where like everything was these more of a rambler style ranch. And they didn't like, they say, oh, I hate ranches because they think of that. They think of maybe their grandparents' ranch house. But the truth is, you don't have to have that style. And you can absolutely can remodel a ranch home easier than a two-story. I mean, it's a no doubt about it. Without question. And you start opening them up and you start taking advantage of what people look for now, which more open concept and more, you know, clean lines and more light, you can actually accomplish quite a bit.
So we are at an interesting time in the market where it is really competitive to close on these houses. And it's a situation where millennials or people looking to start their first home, perhaps they've had children, you know, a good starter for them to own a property. And then you have your older population, the boomers, we can categorize it as, that are looking to downsize, to find somewhere to age in place. Do you both find that this is a unique period, or have there always been ebbs and flows of this competitive nature of two massive populations competing for a limited amount of the same style house?
I'll answer that in a different way. I certainly don't know about how the market is competing. That's definitely a Sarah Joe question. But I do think that we're kind of resetting back to a more normal way of looking at housing, which is people really want to get, they want to stay longer than they did. I mean, I know my wife and I bought our house in 2006. And at that point in time, we're like, oh, we'll be here for 3 years and then we'll sell it because that's what was happening. Now we've been there for 13 years? And we just made the decision that we're staying there. We're not moving. And it's a little, we have a little ranch home in the city of Milwaukee because the house works for us. And I think people now are like, okay, find a house that works for us, something that we can live in for a long time. I just talked to a gentleman I know who's not from this market, but he was telling me how he and his wife had bought a house and they remodeled it because they're in their mid-50s, but they want to live there basically forever. And so they bought a ranch because it's super easy to make that age-in-place type of home, and they just want to stay there. And I think that younger people are feeling the same way too. Like, they're no longer like, oh, I need to get the biggest, biggest house. They say, you know what? I want a house that I can afford, that I can actually pay off in a reasonable amount of time, that I don't need to have a mortgage for the rest of my life. And if you can find a smaller home and a more sensible home, you know, ranches do allow you to kind of expand a lot easier, I think, than maybe some two stories. You know.
Especially my first time homebuyers, they're looking at the big picture of what does it cost to maintain the home, the heating costs. And so all of that is factored in as well. So that adds to the savings when you're looking at a smaller sized ranch home. As far as what they're looking for, I think it's interesting that the 1950s ranches, I think like 9 out of every 10 homes, I read a statistic, was being built was a ranch home. So there is that historical aspect too for people buying as a first-time homeowner now. So they have that history of the home, whereas we didn't see a 1950s ranch as a historical home before. So there is the romantic idea of reviving that history of when their grandparents might have lived in a home like that and bringing it up to modern standards and with that real minimalist approach to it, with not overdoing it, but keeping it real simple.
Obviously, do you think the economy also adds to that? People don't have perhaps as much money to spend on a house and a down payment.
Completely. They don't have it, and maybe they don't want to because the value is more in experiences and what they're doing outside the home and putting a value.
Yeah, I think it's a priority thing. I think that they're realizing that, hey, you know, it's not about having the biggest house and you know, not like, okay, we're gonna have a starter home in 1,500 square feet, and then we're going to buy another one, it's 2,500. And then eventually we're going to get to a 4,000 square foot home. I mean, I think there's two things that are happening, and they're both related to the idea that we frankly, as far as new construction goes, and we do a little bit of new construction, so I don't want to sound like I'm trashing the new home builders out there because they were building what people were asking for. But we kept building bigger and bigger and bigger, and people just kind of felt like, well, that's what I should be getting. And I think what you've got here is you've got a younger generation that's coming into it, and they're kind of shaking it up and saying, why? And I think the other thing, when we talk about the historic stuff, I think is interesting, is I think people are looking at these houses, at these 50s, 60s, 70s era ranches, and saying they've got good bones. And I think that's in large part because, to be perfectly honest, we've built, as an industry, a bunch of really cruddy houses over the last 30 years. And now you've got young people coming up and they're looking at houses that were built in the late 90s, early 2000s, that they would be the logical next buyer for. And they're looking at them and they're like, yeah, these windows
in worse
are
shape than the older
the
ones.
Windows are shot. Exactly. They need to be replaced. They're seeing all these problems, and they say, well, why don't we just get this house with good bones? I bet you're seeing stuff like that.
Absolutely.
Where people are seeing that with their buying houses.
Now, also on the market value with that, since technically they're seen as more affordable homes for young buyers, people looking to downsize, but with such high competition, we're seeing these homes sell for a lot more than assessed value. Do you see repercussions in this down the road?
You know, nobody has a magic eight ball to say what's going to happen. And that is a hard thing because appraisers are looking in a rear view mirror and we're moving faster than they can look at for home values. I just think you have to be smart. There are always going to be people that will outbid in a market. You just have to be really cognizant of what are the sales. How much do I value living in this neighborhood? What is my circumstance now? I don't see anything going too much above and beyond. There's definitely certain pockets that are, I think, pushing the envelope a little bit. But I think it's just being competitive, and it hasn't been for so long that we're seeing the values trickle up to where they should be.
Now, Lewis, you mentioned that good bones is key when someone's looking to buy a new house. Do you find that a lot of buyers are willing to do the work, that they're seeing these ranch homes? And like, what are the most common projects that are being done to give them a little bit more new life or updates?
Well, I mean, the most common remodeling projects across the board are and will pretty much always be kitchens and bathrooms. Those are pretty straightforward. Ranches especially, also bungalows sometimes fit this bill, is that it's easier to do your work in phases.
It's functional and livable.
Yeah, and you're not having to basically disrupt your whole life.
Now, with ranch homes, do you see, I mean, obviously, as you mentioned, Sarah Jo, there's no magic eight ball, especially with the market, and it's always a guessing game. But you yourselves also just living in ranch homes, do you see this as something that will continue to be a strong, you know, motivator for new homeowners and then people also looking to downsize? You mentioned they're still building ranch homes. Granted, it might not be the exact same layout or classic caricature we think of, but their priorities are changing.
Priorities are changing, and I think, you know, we've got beautiful seasons here in Wisconsin, even though we have snow today. One nice thing I like about ranch homes is it really incorporates the inside and the outside. You feel like with all of the windows, you're bringing the outdoors in all the time. And I love that about ranch homes. And I think there's an appeal for that, too. Most people in Wisconsin enjoy the outdoors. Granted, we have a fluctuation of all different seasons, but that's the beauty of it, too, right? So I like that component of ranch homes, and I think that's a real value for them and a real attraction that's not going to go anywhere anytime soon.
I think that's probably true. It's also a home that's available. You know, there's a lot of them. And so, yeah, there are always going to be people who are going to want them because they're going to be on the market because there's a lot out there. I want to go back to a comment that you had before about the cost and about whether or not people are spending a lot of what's happening with the market. And I think this is really important for people to realize. And I honestly think younger people today get it more than, frankly, maybe people in my generation or certainly my parents' generation. And that is that your home really isn't this amazing investment that we maybe sold it to be. It's more than that. I mean, your home, it's an investment in your life and being happy and being able to raise your kids and being able to stand in your kitchen and be preparing dinner and know that the kids are working on their homework and you can see them, to be able to prepare coffee with your spouse in the morning and enjoy it. And so if you find a home that works for you, I think people are more willing to stick around in it. And the truth is, you know, the market's going to be what it is. Some years it's going to be great. And look, there's at some point in time it's going to turn down. It always does. And if you're spending your life trying to play the market with the house that you live in, I think you're just setting yourself up for misery. So it's more of like find something that you love and that you're willing to stay in. And guess what? You might find yourself like Sarah Jo, who never was going to live in a ranch, and now she's there and she loves it. And or like me and my wife, like we bought a house that we are going to be out of in 3 years, and now we're at 13, and we're pretty much deciding we're never going to move out. This is going to be our retirement house, our home base for the rest of our lives, because it's a good house for us, and we don't need to make it bigger. We don't need it to be. It can work for us for whatever stage of life we're in.
Well, Lewis Weyer and Sarah Jo Diedrich, thank you both so much for offering your insights on ranch homes.
Thank you, Audrey.
Thanks, Audrey.
Lewis Weyer is the owner and president of Carmel Builders, and Sarah Jo Diedrich is a realtor with Coldwell Banker. They joined LakeEffect's Audrey Nowakowski, and you can find more information at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.